Welcome to the Best Boss Ever podcast. I'm your host, Christine LaPerriere, president of Leader in Motion. On this show, we're going to gossip about the best boss you ever had. We're going to hear stories about things that they did that helped you feel valued, helped you feel engaged, and really inspired you. We want to hear about the bosses that changed the way you look at everything. If you want to hear more, join me at ChristineLaPerriere.com and sign up for our newsletter, The Whip. And today I have on Brittany Hale. She is got a fantastic story about a best boss, and I am so glad that she's taken the time to talk to me on the show. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, Christine. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
So really quick, why don't you do an introduction so everybody that's listening can hear, you know, a little bit about you.
Absolutely. So my name is Brittany Hale. I am CEO and founder of B&D Consulting Group. And we harness the power of values to ignite better decision-making among leaders. And so much of that was really informed by my time as an attorney. I like to say I'm a happily retired, undefeated trial attorney. And that's really where my best boss story comes from.
Amazing. I can't wait to hear about it. So I'll go ahead and ask that story. Who's your best boss ever and why?
Yes. So my best boss ever is Frank Viscomi. And I went in-house at a Fortune 500 company, and he was wonderful. And so we really hit it off really from the interview on. You know, I was coming from a financial services company. It was the first time that I was going to be litigating, and I knew I could do the role, you know, but I didn't have the traditional experience. And so I don't know if anyone or, you know, Christine, if you've ever felt that gap between your current experience and what you know you're capable of, but you really just need that person to see you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had a really great interview, and toward the interview, I kind of audacious, it was very bold of me, but he said, you know, do you have any questions? And I said, can you see yourself offering me this job?
Ooh.
I know. It was risky. But I figured one of two things would happen. Either he would say no, mm-hmm. and I could get more information about why he couldn't, and maybe, you know, work through some of the misconceptions or work through some of his concerns around offering me the role. Or he could say yes. Mm-hmm. And if I got him to start thinking about, oh, okay, well, yeah, she actually would do well in this role. And then he's already saying yes, so we can just keep the ball rolling. Yes, I can see you this role. Yes, I'm going to extend an offer. Yes, we are going to work together, right? So mm-hmm. fortunately, it worked out where he said, you know, yes, you know, I'm very impressed with you, and I'm curious to see how you would do in the role. And so I got the job, and Frank is such a magnificent attorney and a trial attorney because he's a great storyteller.
Okay.
And he's unflappable. I mean, you could tell him the world was ending and he would say, okay, let's talk about that. And it was incredibly grounding because for anyone listening who's an attorney, you know, there are transactional attorneys who may never see the inside of a courtroom for the duration of their career. And then you have trial attorneys who, again, are quite proud of that because that's where you come alive. And truly anything can happen when you're in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And so you have to have a certain agility, and you have to be able to think on your feet and engage. And it's fun yes. in an odd way. But when you're thrown those curveballs, so much of your success depends on your ability to pivot and to be agile. And so as I prepared for my first few cases, you know, he was, again, very calm, always very grounded and very grounding for that anxious energy that I had. And he sat back and he said, you know, at the end of the day, this is just money. Mm-hmm. And I know we're thinking about it like, oh my gosh, what do you mean it's just money? You know, these are, you know, six figures or, you know, $1 million at stake. And he would say, yes, but it's not someone's life.
Right.
You know what I mean? At stake. And so part of what made him a great boss was one, to set an example for the type of emotional professionalism that was expected within the organization.
I like that. That is powerful. Emotional professionalism.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes. Something we don't get to talk about a lot. And something, I think, when we think of trial attorneys, you know, you see these kind of bombastic personalities or people who are really aggressive and yelling and screaming, but there's something so powerful about having that degree of control. And again, being able to express emotion, but again, to be emotionally professional is something that we don't get a lot of support as we develop our careers, right? We're just on the receiving end of someone's emotions, whether or not they express that at work, but we can feel it, right? You can always feel if a boss is pleased with your work or if they're not. And that nervous energy that can create.
It's really interesting. I love that emotional professionalism. That is a really cool concept. I've never heard of it termed that way. And one thing I'll mention that I see, obviously, it's been 65 episodes of talking to people about their best bosses. And the way certain leaders navigate stress and emotion and some of these kind of wild card behaviors, like what happens is we naturally mirror one another, right? As humans, we naturally pick up information and we mirror one another. So when people have the ability to stay steady when it's stressful or to stay focused when it counts, what you end up doing is you show other people how it can be done.
Exactly.
You know, exactly. So I think that's a really powerful concept.
Yeah. You know, and there's so many, your boss has the ability to truly shape the culture or that framework for decision making within the workplace. So to provide that grounding is reassuring, and it created so much trust because I felt comfortable if I made a mistake coming and saying, hey, I made a mistake. You know, what do I do? And that leads to the next thing that I really appreciated was that he was so supportive of my professional growth, not just within the role, but really just as a whole, you know, and taking a genuine interest, not only in myself, but in my colleagues, a genuine interest in us. We were all so different. And, you know, your litigation style as an attorney is unique to you, you know, and the way that I showed up was so unique to me, and he never encouraged me to be like anyone else except for myself.
Right.
And so to me, I think that's what makes a great boss, is when they take a genuine interest in you and they can see your individual strengths and understand how best to leverage that and align, you know, those business initiatives with the human that you are.
And do you find, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, it's happened to me, but do you find, you know, I was an engineer, you being a litigation lawyer, sorry, a trial attorney, sorry. Neither of us probably match the unconscious bias that comes with those titles.
Correct.
Let's just
Correct.
Be.
Correct.
So is there also something special to the fact that he didn't take one look at you and go, well, you can't be a trial attorney?
100%. Right. So we know for the first time ever that women are outnumbering men very slightly when it comes to being associates in law firms. We see they're starting to outnumber men when it comes to being in law schools. But despite being almost 51% of law firm associates, they're less than 30% of partners. Right. So there's a steep drop off. And, you know, I've had those moments where people would say, are you the secretary? Are you the court reporter?
Right.
You know, like all of these moments that could have chipped away at my confidence and my ability to show up and advocate on behalf of my clients. However, because I knew that he saw me and felt comfortable enough, there are some attorneys who have to wait almost a decade before they're off to the races and they see the inside of a courtroom. And he believed in me enough to allow for me to go out by myself and see what happens. Yeah. And that was a huge vote of confidence. And so even when I pivoted out of litigation and into leadership and workforce development, that was something that I always took with me, because even when we parted ways and I said, you know, Frank, I'm leaving, he was so supportive. And, you know, that support continued throughout my career. And as he's been able to watch the various iterations of my business grow and scale, he's still been supportive. And it's always been a truly, truly fantastic experience that I've held near and dear.
That's so cool. So is there any like specific examples when you think of those interactions with Frank? Give me some examples of, you know, when he was coaching you or when he had to give you, you know, tough feedback. What are some, give me some of those moments.
Absolutely. So the great thing about Frank, and when I went on to lead other organizations and manage dozens of people and myself, you know, I echoed some of that, which was to be grounded, to be interested. But there was a certain point where attorneys, as you know, they have billable hours. But it's not just the hour, you're actually billing every 6 minutes of that hour. And so you can imagine that takes working an 8 hour day or a 10 hour day or a 12 hour day, it's exhausting. So there would be days where I would, you know, maybe I didn't bill because I was in court, I come home, I'm thinking about the case for the next day, you know, and I had to develop a system where I could bill concurrently and not try to bill at the end of the month or think back and say, oh my gosh, what did I do on the 13th? I have no idea.
Right. It's easy to forget all that detail.
It is easy to forget that detail. And so we had a conversation where he was giving some tough feedback, but he did it with such compassion. And he started off by assuming positive intent, which is something that I went on to encourage the people that I went on to lead as well. Where he said, I know you're working hard. I see the product of your work, right? I see the motions, you know, going out. I see that you're going to these depositions, that you're having these phone calls. I see the work. And I want to make sure that you get your credit, but you've got to help me get you there. Right? You've got to enter those. So, you know, in those moments when we're receiving feedback, it's easy to want to be defensive. It's easy to immediately want to fight back. But because he delivered that feedback by assuming positive intent, you know, I couldn't defend and immediately go into defense mode and say, well, you know, I'm working so hard and you don't understand, and, you know, all of these things.
Right.
I felt validated. So my walls came down and I was able to receive the feedback, and we were able to have a productive conversation about what the solution could be.
Nice.
And that was something when I became a people manager and went on to lead an organization that I remembered so clearly. How can I provide this feedback? Because I do want to see them grow, right? I don't have a vested interest in seeing them perform poorly. So how can I create a space where they feel safe enough to grow? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we can work together to build out those solutions. You know, I never wanted someone to feel surprised or not have a reference point, but starting off by saying, look, I know XYZ is important to you. I know that you want this promotion. Here's what I need to see to get you there.
Perfect. I mean, I think that's such a great example, again, of how, you know, I always say your best boss is not your nicest boss. They weren't just smiling at the coffee pot all the time, or, you know, it's really, how did they coach you?
and enable growth. And that means that there's going to be tough conversations in there. There can't be growth without a tough conversation that says you're not doing everything perfect. is where the growth comes, right? But it's such a great process that you just walked us through, that assuming positive intent. So he's framing that feedback in a way that it makes it very accessible for you.
Correct.
You know, which is cool. Amazing. Any other examples that you have from working with Frank?
You know, again, the one that comes to mind was just, you know, with him just saying, look, it's just money, mm-hmm. you know, we will. And that was, I guess, the benefit of working for a Fortune 500 company is that they understood the risk of showing up in court. They understood what the potential exposure could be. And that was a risk that they were willing to take. And so it was important for him to provide that larger perspective because, you know, without a great boss, right? Without your best boss, it's very easy to allow your fears to take over your decision-making and spiral you into making decisions that you might not have made without a clear, you know, if you didn't have a clearer head. So I really, really appreciated those moments where I said, okay, yes. And even in my business now, you know, no one's going to prison, you know, it's right. not a loss of life. We're grounded in the growth of people, of organizations. You know, how can I use values to grow people and profits? And so those are the moments that, you know, even though it'll almost be 10 years since I started there, Frank is an incredible boss. And those moments are something that I will keep with me always.
Amazing. So now I want to ask you a question. You know, I get a lot of questions about, kind of to the point you just made, questions about investing in leaders and helping them become, you know, best bosses. What's the return on investment? And so when you think of an example of working for Frank, what do you think the return on investment was to the business by having employed somebody as great as a leader as Frank?
If I had to quantify that, I would ask them to look at turnover rates, because there are some people who I knew were staying in the role. They could have made more money in other places, but it was worth it to stay to work for Frank. That's crucial, because most organizations need you to stay at least 16 to 18 months to receive a return on their investment in onboarding you.
Yep.
And so if you aren't a great boss, you know, and the person cycles out after 6 months and says, oh, see ya, it's expensive. Turnover is expensive. And so to have a great boss like Frank, I'm confident that the organization was able to quantify the value that he brought, even in turnover alone.
I also think what you mentioned that I think is a very interesting thing. You know, if you think of, like, we had a war on talent in the last couple of years, it's kind of died down a little bit, but we did have this like intense war on talent. And it was just so easy to leave for more money. Like, there was just dollars being thrown around. And it's interesting, because when you have a best boss, the grass doesn't always look greener. Even if they throw some pretty good cash in there, you know, it doesn't always look greener. Now, if you don't have a best boss and somebody says, hey, you know, we've got this great signing bonus, we have whatever, whatever, that risk feels a lot easier to handle. You know, it's a lot easier to stomach.
Absolutely. You know, and recent studies have shown that money is not the greatest motivator when it comes to retaining talent or attracting talent, right? So, you know, you could go to, you know, a top 50 law firm where you're working at least 80-hour weeks and you're making great money, but the cost that it takes in, you know, anxiety and fear and the inability to meaningfully engage with your family. You know, we had attorneys who would say, listen, you know, my childcare fell through, or it's a, you know, I have to finish this motion, but I also have this little person with me, and his flexibility, even prior to the pandemic, when everyone's coming into the office, or if there was a court day, you know, and saying, look, I don't need to see that you're in the office. I know that you're working, but communicate. You know, these are those moments where if you're a boss, that's the type of power that you get to exercise, right? That institutional power where you're creating environments for people to grow and to thrive. That beats out the personal power of, you know, butts in seats and I get to tell you what to do every time.
That's amazing. And I mean, I see something else too, by him being able to believe in people that maybe, I have no idea, but I'm imagining you don't look like Frank. You don't talk like Frank. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? I'm imagining he has a, and this is one of the things with diversity and inclusion is that, you know, we spend so much time talking about women building up leadership skills and negotiation and all this stuff. But what we don't understand is I really do believe the path to diversity and inclusion is going to be from having best bosses. And that doesn't matter what Absolutely. Profile, right?
Absolutely.
If he shows you, I don't care, you know, who you are. I don't care, you know, whether you match my, you know, picture of the title or not. Again, I'm coming out of engineering, so I've experienced a lot of that. But I'm going to invest in you, and I'm going to see you, and I'm going to see your strengths, and I'm going to build them up. It just creates this pathway for anybody to come in and be grown under him, right?
Absolutely. That is the crux of DEI, right? Is
right.
How do we provide the resources to create an environment where people of varying backgrounds can contribute? You
right.
know, some of my greatest advocates and mentors have been 50, 60 plus, you know, year old white men. You know, on its face, we don't seem to have anything in common initially, but their interest in being leaders, their interest in leading with values, right? And I always mm-hmm. emphasize values because values are by definition inclusive. There's no one has a monopoly on hard work or respect or integrity. And so if that's what you're concerned with, you don't care what the person looks like. You're not solely rooted in ego and, okay, this person looks like me and that makes me feel comfortable. It's what do you want to achieve? You know, what excites you? We're both excited by these things. How can I share my experience so that you and I can have a similar impact in our chosen fields?
Right. That gets me really excited because, again, I think, you know, we have some younger leaders that by nature, you know, are inclusive, kind of built in their DNA a little bit. But I do see one of the challenges in some businesses are, just like you said, the, you know, an older generation of men who are used to male-dominated business environments. And it's harder for them when somebody walks in the door and they don't have anything in common that minute
right.
for them to go, I don't know if I can picture this person, because they can picture
right.
themselves doing the job, but they can't picture somebody completely different than them doing the job. And what I am imagining is just how, to your point, his values must have been, you don't have to be like me to do the job well. I'm going to really see you for
Absolutely.
Your strength and not be quick to assume otherwise. I love that.
Absolutely.
To me, leaders like that, it's such a cool, this goes back to my point. We need more Franks. The more Franks we have, the more we're
going to
create.
Exactly.
You know, and you and I are going to build great careers and we're going to go on and lead people the same way. But right at the moment when the stats in those roles are still male dominant, we need to create great leaders, male and female, who are going to be inclusive. So I get excited about that. So now, really quick, one worst boss ever, not that it has to be that bad, but have you ever worked for somebody that it just was not nearly as great of an experience as Frank?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, if we were to solely base it in appearance, right, this person and I would have seemed to have gotten along better or had more in common, but our values were completely divergent and did not align at all. And so whereas I focused on being a values-led leader and genuinely interested in people, right, and mm-hmm. how we can motivate people toward a mission, this person was vehemently, I don't care.
Yes.
I don't do the people thing, right? So That experience was equally instructive. You know, I learned so much and I'm still very thankful for that experience, because when I go in and I engage with these leaders, right, who for one reason or another are needing some support in growing themselves, I'm able to find a level of compassion. I understand the pressures on them. I understand what they're going through. I understand that they need to expand their view. And again, not be so focused in and rooted in fear and ego that they're unable to grow themselves and by extension, grow their teams and their organizations.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is, you know, worst bosses are never, so many of us see the gift, right, in an experience with a worst boss. But I always keep challenging, like, how come so many of us keep saying our leadership school was just a school of hard knocks of worst bosses? I keep going, think about it. Like, you wouldn't want a heart surgeon who's like, well, I've never really worked with a great heart surgeon, but I've worked with a lot of lousy ones. So I've learned what to do.
Exactly.
I've learned what not to do. And you're like, that doesn't make me feel good.
Right. It'll be a horrible experience, but you'll be so much more grateful to be alive at the end of it. Like, we can just circumnavigate that whole experience from the outset, right?
That's what I think. You know, I mean, it is great to learn when you've, you know, for you, obviously, it sounds like it really helped you see how value-centric you are and what your values are. So that worst boss ever experience really helped cement that. And I think, you know, I can align with that too. I think that's what I've gotten out of my worst boss experiences is, you know, I know so much more about myself and what I can live with and what I can and what are my non-negotiables. But on the flip side, you know, value to the business, like neither of us still work for those worst bosses, right? So
exactly.
probably not racing to go work for them again. So now I asked you about the bottom line. I asked you about the worst bosses. Now, knowing that, you know, this podcast gets a broad reach of leaders who are trying to be best bosses and trying to learn how to strengthen their leadership, what would be the advice or wisdom that you would want to share with them that they could take home today from this?
That's a great question. If I had to sum it up, I would say have the courage to be curious. Again, I've been in positions of leadership. I am in a position of leadership. I understand that very often you're caught between a board of directors and, you know, the teams that you're managing. And there are so few spaces for you to bridge your understanding of your role or bridge your understanding of how to lead. But get curious. You know, and find those people, find the executive leadership coaches or the leadership coaches that can help you navigate this terrain. Because if you say, is it possible that I could lead better? And if so, what would that look like? That takes a lot of courage, because many of us rooted in ego don't even want to consider that, right? You know, I've heard bosses say, if I hire you, they'll know I don't know what I'm doing.
Right.
And so, you know, those are those moments where you say, oh, this is tough. Mm-hmm. Because that's a stressful experience for you. You know, you don't really have any space to really grow. And I can only imagine what it is like for the teams working for you. So
I like the way you said this. And I'm just going to amplify this. I think, is it possible that I could lead better? And if so, what would that look like? What an amazing prompt for people listening to the show today, because we give a lot of tips and insights and different ways that people are doing it. But, you know, to sit down and kind of ask the question, what could I do better? And I'm actually just going to add one more layer to this. You know, I challenged some leaders that I work with this year to do reverse feedback. So at the end of the year, they're doing performance reviews. And I was always like, I don't know why we don't do performance reviews inverted. I just don't know why we don't, because in, you know, engagement surveys and all that stuff, that's fine. And I appreciate all of those tools. But, you know, if I work for you, why isn't there a moment where the direction is that I assess you?
Right.
And, you know, I challenged, of course, I'm so proud of some of the leaders that I work with who, you know, this is my favorite, is when I have ones that I work with who go, well, that's a great idea. They don't even have a minute of hesitation. They just go, well, that's a great idea. And so you know, I have one of my favorite leaders that I coach. She did just that, where she sat down with everybody and said, you know, this is your reverse feedback time. I want you to give me feedback as leaders. Mm-hmm. She asked them to kind of fill out some talking points and things like that. She asked for it directly. She didn't, there's no, what do you want to call it? She's not going to beat anybody with a stick or anything like that. Right. If they give her right. tough feedback, she also didn't make it an HR thing. It didn't have to be, you know, mm-hmm. in anonymous form or, but it was the courage to say, I'm here for it. I'm open to all of it. And then we actually took that data. She summarized where she was going to go lean in this year on her leadership practices. And she presented those back to her team as we did a kickoff this last month. And so it was just very cool because it doesn't phase her. Like, it's just right. kind of like, this is how we do things. Like, you do performance reviews. We're always growing you. I do leadership right. reviews. You guys keep growing me. And we're just all going to hold ourselves to a higher bar this year. I just love how seamless some leaders can do that. The courage to be curious is, she's got it in spades.
And what a great way to build trust, not only in her, but in the organization and in the brand, and to be able to go on the About Us page and say, no, this is accurate. You know, this is really yeah. what we do here.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a lovely exercise and a great challenge for everybody listening. So, Brittany, thank you. It was so fun to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
If you want to hear more, join me at christinelaperriere.com and sign up for our newsletter, The Whip.